Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Music legend Elvis Costello is back in Chicago this Friday night at the Chicago Theater, bringing his musical curiosity in a career spanning more than 30 years. He is perhaps best known for his performances with The Attractions and The Impostors. However, he also has entered into acclaimed collaborations with the likes of Burt Bacharach, Paul McCartney, and record producer and songwriter T-Bone Burnett. Elvis Costello and The Attractions were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2003. And back in 2015, Elvis joined me and superfan Wendy Snyder in our own WGN studios to celebrate his award-winning career. This is Elvis Costello.
Is it all in that pretty little head of yours? What goes on in that place in the dark? Well, I used to know a girl, and I could have sworn that her name was Veronica. Well, she used to have a carefree mind of her own and a delicate look in her eyes.
So I have to start with your recent appearance on Stephen Colbert, where they showed a clip of your dad performing on television, spitting image, obviously, your look, his look.
I am of him.
Exactly. The glasses, the shoes. And you talk about in the book, at such a young age, you know, you use some of his recording equipment as well. It's kind of a like father, like son thing, isn't it?
Well, I suppose it might appear that way. Certainly when my folks were together, my dad was in the front room learning songs that you know, I might have otherwise been told to turn down on my record player in my bedroom, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I was 10 years old when I started paying attention to the music that he was learning weekly. He sang with the Radio Dance Band, as you say. And that particular little clip was a short film that the orchestra he sang with made to commemorate the fact that they just played the very prestigious Royal Command performance The Beatles that year. The Beatles were on it. It's the occasion where John Lennon famously said, well, you can clap along and the rest of you can rattle your jewellery. And that, of course, in those days, people didn't say that kind of cheeky stuff in front of the Queen Mother. So I had this exciting moment of watching my dad on the bill with my, you know, at the time, my favorite group.
That's pretty cool.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah,
and so the Beatles came back to kind of inspire you. A song that was playing that your dad was learning by the Beatles?
Well, yeah. I don't know what he did with all the records he brought home every night, every week, I should say. On this occasion, I was just moved to go in and ask him, what are you doing with that record when you finished with it? Could I have it? And it was Please Please Me, and the rest is misery.
And he was learning that for a performance.
Yeah, he would learn a big stack of records every week because that's the way music was heard in England. It was filtered through all the radio dance bands and palm court orchestras and the cinema organ. We didn't have hours and hours of pop radio. We just didn't. It was the way it was set up. It was because of the agreements with the Musicians Union and the Performing Rights Societies. They were only allowed to play 5 hours of all the recorded music per day.
Wow.
Which meant that a lot of work for you know, working musicians, which was a good thing, kept us in beans and you know, brown ale, but it meant that the versions of the songs that we were familiar with first were often a bit bizarre. You know, they got used to it because that was what they were familiar with, but it was, I think there was a bit of tension between that and the groups of the day who also had to queue up to make guest appearances so their song could be heard. So they would come on these radio shows and play live. That's how I got to see the Hollies up close when I was 10 years old.
Wow.
You know,
wow.
Anyway.
Wow.
But I also got to see them set up. There was some magic to that transformation from a bunch of scruffy lads who walked in carrying their own amplifiers to a group that, and this was a lunchtime radio show, so they would have to somehow spruce themselves up and come out wearing their shiny suits. And
this is at a very young age. I mean, you're being influenced by all this.
Yeah, about 10.
Yeah. Well, first of all, terrific book. This is like a 10-pounder.
It is 600 and some pages, and I didn't have time.
That's the way I asked. I was told that you were paid by weight.
That was very smart.
Well, kudos to you. I didn't have a chance to read this, but I'm so excited to have it. Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink. You're such a lyricist. Everything you say is magical.
Well, thank you.
Well, I mean, you know, your family history, career highs and lows, life experiences. Is it true that you really never kept diaries or notes, really? This is all kind of from the top of your head.
I have a very, very good memory. I'm lucky, and I suppose the disappearing ink part of it is acknowledging the fact that may not always be the case. You know, my dad wasn't lucky enough to keep his memory to the end of his life, his mother before him. You better maybe choose your time when you've done, and there's enough time gone by that you can look back at things clearly and see the value of some of the things. I mean, the book isn't told guided by the calendar. It's, if you're looking for,
right,
I was born,
no,
and then
not
I did
like
this
that.
In all this order. It's not in chronological order. It's in emotional order. It's how these things and the sensations of hearing music, the understanding and the use I made of it later. If that's what you're curious about, then this is the book for you. Definitely.
Yeah, and your dad might
otherwise read Wikipedia.
Yeah, right,
which
exactly.
Is always wrong, by the way. Have you checked your Wikipedia page?
Yeah.
I don't know how that works.
Anyone could get on and edit it. Every time
I'm thinking then of putting a bunch of other stuff on there.
You
I was an Olympic gymnast and stuff like that.
That would be perfect.
Yeah.
Be, and then
anybody
some radio
looking at me would guess that.
Some guy would be asking
some
that
radio
question.
DJ would
That's
be
true.
Like, so what is your specialty in
That's
the
true. That's true.
It's the horse.
Nice.
Handles nice. Or no handles?
Yeah. No handles.
Okay, you're good.
Right in the beginning of the book, chapter 6, you share the fact, you know, and very witty. I mean, just the book is entertaining and funny throughout the whole book as well. I was born in the same hospital in which Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin. I apologize in advance that I have not been the same boon to mankind. I think you did pretty well for yourself.
Not as well as penicillin.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
No, but I mean, that's where you would normally start a book, and that's why I made a joke based on what would be the normal opening line of conventional biography, because then I you know, in each chapter I try to find a way to open up with some sort of anecdote or reflection and let my experiences take me wherever they would. I mean, it's not random. There was a beautifully detailed master plan, you know, like a blueprint, like you would have for a building. No, that's a lie.
I was going to say, wow. It was very
impressive. No, but I almost had you going there.
You did. You did.
But no, I mean, I discovered the structure that once, as you write for a while, and obviously I did work on this for a while, you discover that you have worked towards a structure that is satisfying to you. And, you know, somebody else has, I'm sure, written a book in a more, to them, logical order. To me, tedious. And I just didn't feel it that way. And that's my responsibility, is to tell the tale as I feel it, more than it just be a bunch of facts, you know.
But you talk a lot through the whole book, really, about your dad and kind of what an influence he was in different stages of your life. And your grandfather was also a musician.
My grandfather got out of a couple of institutions playing the trumpet. You know, firstly an orphanage, and then the British Army. I mean, the British Army taught him how to play the trumpet, then sent him to France where he got shot. You know, which is not really what you plan for a trumpet player. He was fortunate to survive. He was missing. And, you know, I think probably then thought, well, maybe I should get a job that's a little less dangerous, and worked on the White Star Line and traveled to America, which was a very exciting prospect for a man of his background. And came to America in the 1920s, which must have been a great time to come, even for a ship's musician.
Sure.
And I've got pictures that both of him evidently enjoying himself.
That's cool.
And sort of things that took his eye. So that's all part of the story, because we all think we invented the mischief of life. Everybody thinks they invented sex. You know, of course, your grandparents, you wouldn't be here unless your grandparents also knew about it. You know,
and
so to know that he was a man alive in the world and got to go to America and saw some of that life, it was intriguing to me, because it's something that drove my dad to leave home to play music, something that drove me to leave home, maybe in a different way, and play music. So, you know, that's another way of telling the tale of how I got here.
What about the Record King of America? Anything about your grandfather represented there?
Well, in the song "American Without Tears," he's mentioned. Yeah, in the lyrics, because at that time in my life, I felt like I was running away from something myself, and made the comparison with a choice that he made to leave to go to America. I was sort of willfully going there, you know. He pops up in a few of my songs. In fact, I've always found some inspiration in talking about my family in the lyrics of songs without necessarily making it a sentimental case. I mean, a well-known song of mine, Veronica, is about my grandmother's drift into Alzheimer's. But, you know, when I was given the opportunity to write that song with Paul McCartney, my impulse was to write a bright, hopeful-sounding song, not a melancholy, mournful song about something you might commonly accompany in that way. And that's something I've discovered over the years. It sometimes works well to my advantage that I take the music and contrast it with the seriousness of the lyric. Otherwise, you're sort of advertising in advance the
meaning.
The meaning, yeah. and the emotional sense. So you can get a little tension playing one against the other.
Dave, one more question, then I'll let you do some interviewing. So
it's all good.
She just wandered in.
It's all good.
We don't actually know who she is.
But so on King of America, are you tributed, it says Elvis Costello, or TLH, is that two left hands because you claim be a good guitarist?
No, a nickname that Nick Lowe, my producer, gave me back in the beginning of my career because I could smash at least four strings off my guitar if I got carried away singing. So he called me the flamenco guitar players would always have very elaborate names, legends after their name, like the, you know, Hands of Quicksilver or something. And so he said I was the Little Hands of Concrete.
The Little Hands of Concrete.
The Little Hands of Concrete, yeah.
Now, you talk about the meaning behind some of your songs and not actually throwing it out there, but it's just part of the fabric of what you write. There's a chapter in the book called Unfaithful Music it's about the song Allison. Mm. You give away a little bit. You know, I believe that Allison was a work of fiction, taking the sad face of a beautiful girl glimpsed by chance and imagining her life unraveled before her. It was a premonition, my fear that I would not be faithful or my disbelief in happy endings would lead me to kill the love that I had longed for. So you have said that the sad face of this beautiful girl was somebody you saw.
Somebody I glimpsed by chance, but it put in focus a feeling I had about myself. And it is a strange experience to write songs that other people see themselves in and know that there's something about yourself. I mean, I didn't advertise the nature of that song when it was first issued. This is something that I've come to accept was there. I've mentioned it in the case of several songs. Some songs are sort of premonitions, maybe because you're writing them as songs. They dig out parts of your own psyche or your own nature or soul or whatever word you want to use to describe it. I've never really thought of it as that kind of divinity. But
do you know how many girls wish their name was Allison when you sang that?
I beg your pardon?
Do you know how many girls wish their name was Allison?
Well, I think there's also probably just as many of being sick of people singing it to them because they they know somebody annoying who heard it once. You know, I think there's actually both. And that's what I know to be true because people have told me. But no, of course, it's always... I would have written more songs of girls' names if I'd known how popular they were going to be.
We'll stick around more with Elvis Costello and more of Wendy Snyder after the news next on 720 WGN.
Oh, it's so funny to be seeing you after so long, girl. And with the way you look, I understand that you were not impressed. But I heard you let that little friend of mine take off your party dress. I'm not gonna get too sentimental like those other stick of Valentines. Cause I don't know if you are loving somebody. I only know it isn't mine. Allison, I know this world is killing you. Oh, Allison.
It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're hanging out in studio with Elvis Costello and Wendy Snyder talking about Elvis's new book, Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink. With the Beatles, you know, you talk about your relationship with Paul in the book and use the Hofner, which is known as the Beatle bass.
Yeah.
And he hadn't picked it up for quite some time.
I don't know that I was... I'm laying claim to the fact. I hadn't seen him playing it you know, obviously it was the guitar I'd grown up watching him play. And then I knew as a fan of the music that he had used a different instrument through Wings. And certainly when we first started working together, he was using a bloody terrible kind of fusion-sounding bass that I didn't care for. And, you know, we were co-producing, but at this point I was actually co-producing the recordings of the songs we'd written. So we had built up a more of a relationship of working together in the process of writing a dozen songs. And I sort of said, well, you ever thought about playing that other bass, you know? And when he got it out, you know, it was... I don't think it was really fit for playing it. It was, I think he thought of it just as a souvenir.
Sure.
You know? But when he played it, he really, really sounded like, you know, what is very distinctive. He's an amazingly distinctive, unique bass player, and would be on any instrument, but mm-hmm. particularly distinctive when playing that bass, because it sort of I guess it's a lighter touch or something, and he just seemed to be able to fly around it. And anyway, it was just tremendous to see him play it. You know,
well, and the randomness of how you met him. It was his kids playing down the hallway that kind
well,
of.
Well, that was we had played on a we played on Wings' last ever show at a charity event in 1980. But then we found ourselves in adjacent studios in the early 80s, and you know his kids, you know, who of course I know now, they were teenagers and little kids then, and they, you know, they were at work with Dad. You know, that's the other thing I try to get across in the book is that everybody's just a human, you know. Mm-hmm. They're getting on with their daily job, and of course, when you have a legendary name like his, people imagine everything they do is in this sort of attitude. But the reality of it is, they get to work and do their job, you know.
You talked a lot in the book too about, you know, defining yourself as a performer, and you kind of got cast as like the angry guy a little bit throughout your career.
I love the way you did that with your hands when you said the angry guy.
The angry guy.
Yeah, because that obviously wasn't all it was about. And you would just have to listen to listen really to the songs, not just to the first impression of them. I think even the first couple of records, to know there was conflict. There was emphatic things said, some things that were, I suppose, aggressive. Also some regret and tenderness in songs like Allison. So
sure. It
would be a simplification. And I always thought it was, as I was saying it, I thought, well, of course you know there's more to it than that. That's why I'm saying this.
Yeah.
Because you know, I know you're going to challenge it. And a lot of people just wrote it down, and then it became like, you know, my business card for a while.
Sure.
But I got over that.
After SNL.
Some other people didn't get over it so well. You know, I got over it a long time ago, and that's what I've been working at, is doing all these other songs ever since.
Well, speaking of SNL.
Yeah, and you got over it after the SNL appearance.
Yeah, the SNL thing, I think, is all... it's very much more talked about in America, because people, including ourselves, didn't know what SNL was. That's one of the reasons that we perhaps ran into that problem there. Because we were told the show was like Monty Python.
Yeah.
Because I suppose
it's the alternative
to more mainstream comedy. That's all they meant by saying that. Bear in mind that we'd only been in the country 2 or 3 weeks, and every Saturday night we'd been working. So we'd had no opportunity to see the show. And the scrap that I was having was not so much with the show in any case. It was the record company wanting us to sing a specific song. Me thinking that song isn't really going to mean anything to people in America. I want to sing this then newly completed song, Radio Radio. And hey, live was in the name of the show.
Yeah, right.
It seemed like a pretty good guess.
Yeah,
that we could do that.
Absolutely.
But, and the strange thing about it is that you have to remember, there were no video recorders to speak of back then. So anybody that tells you they saw it after the fact is not telling the truth. They're remembering the little bit of reportage,
a little bit of a wise tale
at the time. And of course, later it was repeated, and then once people started doing, you know, like when Sinead O'Connor tore up the picture of the Pope, somehow I got the blame.
When
Ashley Simpson caught lip-sync, somehow I got the blame.
Yeah.
It's been nice of them to keep blaming me for that. But of course, I was back on NBC within 3 years.
I was going to say, it was a short-term ban.
I didn't do SNL for 12 years, but maybe I wouldn't have been on it anyway. It's not your turn to be on every show. You know, it's like...
Sure.
I mean, all those shows are like a ride at the fun fair. You have to get the back of the queue if you want to go on it again.
True.
Yeah.
And when you sat in for David Letterman, you were brilliant as an interviewer.
Thank you. I enjoyed doing that. I mean, David was, his producers were always very welcoming. I was on the show about 29 times as a music guest, maybe 30, I don't know. With all sorts of configurations. I played solo, I played with the Attractions, I played with the Imposters, I played with Burt Bacharach, and I played with some of my friends, you know, from other fields of music, the Fairfield Four, the Gospel Quartet, and myself, and the Jazz Passengers.
And I played with Paul, of course.
Yeah, and they let me play with all these people on the show. So when it came time to host, it was, you know, it was good fun to do that for one evening. I don't know that I would want to be doing that every night.
But you hosted your own show for a little while.
Different sort of form. You know, Spectacle was a show we did for Sundance Channel and CTV up in Canada, and it was conversation and music. So I was trusted by my victims to come in, and they share the stage willingly. But we share the similar job in the sense that we go onto the stage with words and music at our disposal and try to tell some sort of story. So whether it be Renee Fleming, the opera singer, or Lou Reed, very different sound of music, but still it's the same proposition. So there was always something in common, and it seemed to allow them to trust me, and we got to do I got to sing with some people that I never imagined I'd ever sing with, like Smokey Robinson.
Well, and depth to these conversations too. I saw a lot of them on YouTube. It was pretty cool.
Because it wasn't sound bites. We were able to talk it, you know, full sentences, and they were able to illustrate. People were very generous with their time. Bruce Springsteen did, I think we must have been in the Apollo Theater for 4 hours, you know, so a short night for Bruce.
Yeah.
That would be a short night for him. In America, where the 1980s came around and music videos and MTV were out there, did you feel like that was really where you got a bigger splash and people got to really see you and see your performances?
Music videos are absurd. I mean, they there's a lot in the book about the absurdity of pop music. From very early on, when I was just in a semi-pro band, I described one night when I was lurking backstage between sets with my semi-pro band, and a reggae singer got up and lip-synced to his hit, which was from 5 years earlier and still upstaged us. So, I mean, I got a glimpse then, because he was well-known, you know.
Yeah.
So people went crazy when they saw him. They didn't care whether he had the microphone stuck up the arm of his jacket when he tried to take his jacket off halfway through the song. People were just taken by the illusion of him singing. And make note of the fact that my voice was not heard on the BBC for the first 7 years or so of my career. Every single appearance on the BBC was lip-synced. So it was just some pictures of me in stupid clothes, you know. And on other channels, you know, obviously SNL, we were very much playing live.
Yeah.
And there were other opportunities to play music live. But I music videos in themselves were inherently ridiculous. They were, you know, they... The first ones were just us filled full of vodka and shoved in and jumping around.
And was a lot of jumping going on.
A lot of jumping around, yeah. And then the later ones, you know, where we were making Casablanca or something, you know.
Yeah.
So there was some... They love to do those ones where the director would say, we've got this great idea. It's going to be like Ingmar Bergman. But it's a 5-minute pop song or 3-minute pop song. How can it be? You know,
the Veronica video was beautiful. Yeah.
Once in a while, Evan English, who I worked with on Veronica and I Want to Be Loved, those two videos added something to the feeling of the song, because he did something with the structure of the, you know, he had me singing along with the record in both of those, which created a different effect. And, you know, he framed it with images that actually echoed the meaning of the song. That was good. The more abstract ones were that you were just... in some, you know, you're in a lifeboat and the lifeboat's on fire. I don't know what that is about. We never actually made that one. I just thought about it.
Sounds like a Monkees episode.
Yeah. Well, few of them were like
Monkees. That's a comparison.
We hired a villa in the south of France to do a bunch of them, and we took dancing lessons because we thought we were going to look like the Miracles. And this I don't know what had gone on in this villa, but the center of the living room had a Roman bath in it, so I didn't really want to think what kind of bacchanalia had gone on in there. So we filled it full of water and sort of fell into it fully clothed. Naturally, it was like a Monkey's episode. Exactly, that's what they were.
That's
funny. All they should have been.
What a funny comparison. Yeah. That's fabulous.
I want to jump in with one. The Roy Orbison work you did. Mm. Loved it. He performed a song you wrote for him.
Yeah, I think the Black and White Night, which has been seen many times now, was a beautiful film. Shot at the Coconut Grove in the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, with everybody in the band was, you know, just sensational musicians. The TCB band, who were Elvis's band, Bonnie Raitt and Katie Lang were singing in the background group. Timo Burnett put the music together. You know, this was one of the first film things that he had done of that scale. Bruce Springsteen came and made a very kind of, you know, he really, you had to be persuaded into the spotlight because he had such love and admiration for Roy. And I thought so much of the way he carried himself that night, because he was absolutely the height of his Born in the USA fame. And
sure,
it could have easily tipped the gig away from Roy, but everybody was all about playing behind him. And it was, you can imagine as a songwriter, you know, to hear Roy sing something you've dreamed of him singing in your head and then be actually playing in the band behind him with the spotlight coming, you know, past him. It was really like something, I mean, that perspective isn't caught, of course, on the film, but it's something that's in my memory forever, you know.
I have one more question for you. You have, you know, 30 studio albums under your belt, Silk, 6 live albums, 14 compilation albums, 62 singles. Your dad passed away about 4 years ago, and you said in the book how difficult it was, obviously, for you and would be for anyone. But you felt in the first time in your life that you had trouble writing another song because your dad couldn't hear it.
It wasn't really writing the songs that was difficult. It was difficult to imagine. I'd always loved the moment. It was some part of my process of making records was at some point before it was released. I've been lucky enough to involve my parents. There's never been a division, a generational division about music. I'm probably the product of the fact that my dad was involved in the same music as,
sure,
you know, was prohibited by other parents. And my mother, too, who sold music. They had
she
an
did,
open mind.
Record store, yeah.
Yeah, they
yeah.
had an open mind about music. So facing that moment of completing something and just acknowledging that he wouldn't be there to hear it, I know it seems a funny thing to say, but I found it an insurmountable obstacle and it coincided also with the fact that it seemed to be more of a vanity on my part to make the record at all, because then my shows are successful, but the shows are not generated by the record releases. The interest in them is created by the songbook, which is an accumulation of all of these,
sure,
records you mentioned. And the way I've gone about it since that time has been, well, some slightly before that time, is in finding a way to frame all of these songs and sort of erasing the date stamp on them.
Okay.
I'm not thinking about this is the album that we're going to
have
to play the songs
from
this album.
Right.
When I had the Spectacular Spinning Songbook, a game show wheel with all the songs.
I was there at the Riviera,
yeah,
three,
yeah,
shows,
so
Chicago.
There you are. You know that was a way of making all of the, literally anything could happen. Sometimes you'd get your finale song first, sometimes you'd open with a ballad. The Detour show that I do now is, I did think about it in advance of the completion of Unfaithful Music to Spring Inc. as being part of the same storytelling. I use some of the same images that are seen in the book. Some of the anecdotes you'll read in the book, people who've been to see me play recently will recognize.
That's cool.
As being great stories I've told in preface to songs. But the difference is I've usually told them like in a lighthearted way. When you read the final pages of the book are a description of my father and I on a stage in a club in Blackpool in the northwest of England. And the story I've always told is that when the light went on, I realized that the organist had given me the wrong note and I was out of tune with the band. So at 17, when I was there sort of playing with my father for the first time, I had to roll my volume off and pretend to play, to sort of, as it were, mime, mm-hmm, the playing of the guitar. You know, when I tell it on stage, people laugh at it because it is a comical image. But when you read it in the context of the story of the whole of the book, it has more emotional weight to it because of the context it's read in. And I'm looking forward to going back on the stage with Detour in the light of the fact that people, some
have
people
now
have read
the book.
The book,
right.
They'll understand a little more. There are songs which, if I play them, there's a chance that people know what they've meant to me, how I got to them in the first place. Not necessarily who is Alison? It's a bit of a
sure
facile question.
Right.
But maybe some songs that are really deeply felt to me that are, you know, haven't been in the hit parade, but that doesn't make them lesser songs. If I can sing them and hold your attention and convince you in the moment, quite often the height, you know, the real moment in my shows is when a song that is not so well known is the one that really gets the attention. That's when you feel like you're doing something in the moment. That's something that records can't replicate. It's something that can't be stolen on a phone camera. It can't be downloaded. it has to happen in the company of other people, because it's recognition of a moment which is unique and specific to that night, and next night it'll be different. Everything will happen in a different order. The emphasis will be in a different place. And the feeling for even the best known and the longest sung song in my repertoire will be different from night to night because of the way I go about it.
Which makes it fabulous.
It makes it more alive to me, and it I does. Hope for the audience, and that's where I'm not cheating them by coming out and singing something for cheap applause. I'm coming out and trying to get to the point of every song I sing. Do I get there every night? Who could?
Right, you know, exactly.
But I try my best to come to present myself with the challenge of working how all of this is connected. I've been lucky enough for these songs to come to me. I better work with them until I can't do it.
Well, all these stories, I mean, and we just touched the surface, are in Elvis's new book. It's called Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink, and you can pick that up at Amazon or wherever books are sold. And for more on anything Elvis Costello, visit elviscostello.com. Great having you in studio with One
Thank
Day and I tonight.
And,
Thank
and
you
also,
so much.
May I say, it's great if people go and get it delivered to their house, but go to your local bookshop.
Go to that
place where the people really think about books. Go to the shop that you love and buy the books that you love. I have a strong feeling. I think it's great that the big bookstores there have all the stock that they can afford to carry everything. But, you know, there's a bookstore everybody knows in one neighborhood or another where there are people who really have thought about the books they put on display, and I appreciate, you know, their care.
And supporting their local business.
In the same way as it's always been for me, the record shops were like that. That's how I learned the music that I learned. In fact, all I knew were just one or two songs that came out of America on compilation albums. I'd come and find
in the music stores.
Whole big sort of racks full of, whether they were, you know, brand new records or secondhand records or pawn shop records. Wherever you get it,
sure.
You know. Yeah, but I appreciate that.
Thank you, Elvis.
Thank you very much.
All right, can I do my interview with him?
Yeah, yeah. Right after this.
Are we doing it now?
720 WGN.